listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kiko Bourne, and this is Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in D.C. Every Monday at noon, I spend lunch break with advocates, doctors, parents, and more to learn about their agenda for the food system. And I ask each guest for one action our listeners can take to change things for the better. You can see pictures of the show at Kiko Buff on Instagram. So thus far on Lunch Agenda, I've interviewed guests related in some way to my 4 years working at the Capital Area Food Bank on hunger and nutrition issues. What I haven't talked about yet is the work I'm doing these days when I'm not producing this show. I am very proud to be the self-named Director of Breadjucation at Salu Bakery and Mill, which opened last year in Blagden Alley in the Shaw neighborhood of D.C. Since joining the team at Salu, I've learned about grain and baking with Levain to help our guests understand Salu's approach. My goal today is to cram as much breadjucation as I can into 3 episodes of Lunch Agenda. So in today's episode, we'll talk with Heinz Tomet, a Maryland farmer who, through growing and milling wheat, rye, barley, and other crops, is trying to help the public get back to eating whole grains. We'll also hear from a scientist, David Killalay, who researches the nutritional content of flour sold at supermarkets these days. Then in the second Breadjucation episodes, we'll talk with the Salu team, and in the third, with experts on the history of Mid-Atlantic regional grain growing and its future prospects. But first, Kiko's food news. First headline of the day. A science research journal published some remarkable maps that illustrate the vast scope of human exploitation of the ocean. By tracking commercial fishing operations, it reveals that 55% of the world's oceans are being fished, an area 4 times larger than the area devoted to agriculture on land. Pretty staggering. Headline 2. Shoppers in Amsterdam had the chance to visit Europe's first plastic-free supermarket aisle in what may be a turning point in the war on plastic pollution. The store has more than 700 plastic-free products, which will not be any more expensive than plastic-wrapped goods and will be scalable and convenient using alternative biodegradable packaging when necessary. So I'll be eager to see whether that trend is able to spread across the ocean to the States. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I will introduce my guests and we'll get talking about grain. Stay tuned.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night.
Welcome back to Lunch Agenda. Let's get breaducated. I'm talking today with Heinz Tomet, who many listeners may know from visits to buy his grains, beans, veggies, and more at DuPont Farmers Market in the past. Heinz is originally from Switzerland, but since 2000, he's had an 86-acre certified organic farm located in southern Maryland, about 50 miles south of D.C. Heinz lives and farms there with his wife, Gabrielle LaJoie, I'm going to ask him to make sure I pronounced that right, and 3 daughters. Their mission at Next Step Produce is committed to growing nourishing food in harmony with nature. So welcome, Heinz. So grateful that you're joining me for Lunch Agenda.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Great. And how do I pronounce your wonderful wife's last name? Did I say it right?
Lajoie.
Lajoie. Oh, bien sûr. Okay. So, Heinz, first I want to ask you a few questions about your farming approach more broadly. Can you tell us where you learned to farm?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Switzerland, and the traditional farm in Switzerland is probably started out as a homestead type farm, and then you had a few crops you would sell to make some money. So, and a traditional farm would be, you know, you would grow grains, you would have an orchard for apples, and you would have some livestock.
Okay. And then a friend who actually works right near Newburgh, where you farm now, wanted me to ask, why Newburgh? How did you end up choosing to, you know, build your farm there?
Well, let's go back a little bit more to the first question before we come to the next one. You know, traditionally in Europe, to become a farmer is a trade. There is an apprenticeship required to be a farmer. You don't just buy a piece of land and say you're a farmer. So there is an apprenticeship. And then traditionally the European approach is you do your apprenticeship and then you do your journey years. And you may have read in those things in some medieval books, but that's still happening there. So I learned, you know, I learned and then I did my journey years, and that's all part of who I then became. So right. That's, you know, that's the learning part. Now with why Newburgh, when I sort of finally decided to settle down, I wanted to be far enough south so I could grow figs. So like north of D.C., I can't grow figs anymore. I wanted to be a place where it is dark at night and quiet. I wanted to be able to drink the water from my tap without thinking twice about poisoning my system. But I also wanted to be close enough to a metropolitan to do direct marketing. When you farm, you know, if I guess you can make a living selling head lettuce wholesale, if you know, and you make a penny per lettuce and you sell a million lettuce a day, then yes, you're going to make money, but the work is rather monotonous. So I wanted to be able to do retail and have, you know, a more diversified approach to farming.
That's really interesting to learn. I mean, mostly just things like the fact that you really wanted to grow figs and have it quiet at night. You paint a beautiful picture of your life, and it was a huge pleasure to be able to visit your farm and spend a bit of time there and just see the world that you've built there. So you stayed on your website. When we were asked why grow rice, the answer was because we eat rice. So is that why you grow grain? I'm curious for you to talk about why you got into growing grain and how you think about that crop versus any other produce you would plan to plant for a coming growing season.
You know, just a little bit history there first. The income per acre on vegetables is way higher than on grains.
Right.
So when you start out a new place and your financial resources are limited and you hate to, you know, owe money to other people, so, you know, vegetables certainly allows you to generate a lot more money. Yes, you work a lot harder too, but you don't have the capitalization like you have in grains, for example. So vegetables was sort of the logical place to start out, and then we added fruit like persimmons, figs, kiwis.
I think a lot of people are surprised that kiwis grow in this region.
Well, yes and no, but that's all, you know, kiwi, before they were called kiwis, they were called Chinese gooseberries. So they're native, actually, to China all the way up to Siberia. And then they figured out they grow really well in New Zealand, and the rest is really a marketing. You know, Chinese gooseberry doesn't sound as exciting, I guess, as kiwis.
Hmm.
And then it's all, you know, when you do the marketing, if you have sort of a brand recognition, you know, Kiwis, New Zealand, etc., that's very different than gooseberries, because the few people who ever had gooseberries, for example, they know they're British and they can be more than tart.
Right, right.
They were never patient enough to wait till they're really, you know, ripened.
Interesting.
And then the sugar comes up.
And I recently learned you can eat a kiwi whole, including the furry skin. It's kind of good texture.
See, this is all about how we learn things. Now, then coming back to the grains.
Right, please do, yes.
See, well, nothing is easy in life, is there? So with the grains, you know, we, D.C., Baltimore has a relatively good local food movement. And, you know, that local food movement did address the vegetables, you know, the animal protein, the eggs, all that stuff. You can even, you know, get drunk locally now with the alcohol available from local breweries. But the grain was sort of forgotten along the way. So, you know, on one side, the Mid-Atlantic or New England used to be the breadbasket, and then we had better growing conditions in the Midwest, and somehow we forgot all about it.
Right.
So now with the rice, you know, that was, oh, that's probably 30 years ago when I was farming in New Jersey, and I read an article about a guy from Jamaica moving to Albany, New York, and he was just missing good, fresh rice. So he then started growing rice in Albany and succeeded. So and so in that one sense, I knew you could grow rice. The question was more, can I grow rice? You know, even coming back to rice, like, just north of Japan is an island called Hokkaido, known for very good rice. And then you look on that globe and you figure out, hey, they're as far north as Montreal. And that's quite a bit further north. Or like the northern part of Italy, that's known for risotto.
Right, Arborio rice.
Rice-growing area, and we are as far south as Italy, as Spain. We're actually as far south as Morocco.
Right.
So from a geography perspective, there's nothing really stopping us to grow rice.
And the
it's
same
just
would
the way
be.
History went in America that, like, you know, you go through what? Gridley, California, kiwi capital of the world. Well, they don't come from there originally, et cetera. It's just a lot of it is just how, you know, whatever the factory settled and then the distribution center established itself, but has nothing to do with what the plant likes.
And going back to grain, Heinz, you know, what year did you start growing grain? And I'd love to hear which grain you enjoy growing most or has been most successful for you at Next Step Produce.
Well, at Next Step, I would have to look in my memory long, but it's probably 8-10 years since we started on a, you know, small scale, and probably it was like a winter wheat or winter rye first, and then we, you know, and then, you know, as I said, there's always a learning curve, and then with grain, there's a tremendous mechanization required, particularly on the cleaning side. So it was a sort of a slow organic process. It was not like, you know, some morning I decided to say, oh, let me spend $250,000 and get the machines to grow grains and start it. It was an organic process in that sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then we started to add more and you know, and now we are at the point, like today, with all the wind we had, the ground really dried out. We had sort of relatively wet. But it dried out, so today we're going to plant spring oats, or the Hollis oats, Hollis barley. And with there, that was probably 4 years ago, we got a small handful of Tibetan and Ethiopian and Arabian blue barley, and
wow.
We started to amplify it. And this year should be sort of the last year of amplifying, so we should have a good amount.
What does it mean to amplify a strain of barley?
A number with different varieties. See, and probably when you're going to look into the history of grain growing, the newer varieties tends to yield better. But something went lost in that increased yield and that flavor.
Right.
And, you know, with the local grain production, yes, we can grow rice, for example. No, we will never be able to produce it cheaper than China or Louisiana or California. So I feel strongly that if we have a better tasting rice, then and you eat to nourish yourself, then flavor is part of that nourishment. And then, you know, then absorbing that higher priced item should be a lot easier.
Right, right.
So with like one of the varieties we grow is a Martin Luther Burbank Hollis barley. Protein tends to be higher. Flavor is definitely way better. But you can only buy it at 100 seeds for $5 type deal.
And
so
that's,
how are you going to, you know, and you need, 125 pounds per acre. An acre is 222 feet square, roughly. So, you know, so when you start out with 100 seeds, you know, you seed it, you harvest it, you reseed it, you harvest it, and you do that for several years, and that's called amplifying.
Okay, that's helpful. So I'm going to slightly shift gears, Heinz. I believe farming requires an optimism, and I don't know whether you would consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist. I'd be curious. But, you know, you're casting your lot each growing season that nature will nurture the seeds that you sow. But I've heard in conversations with you, you know, worry. I feel that you farm because you're an environmentalist, but you're worried. And you recently wrote me about how the North Pole has had above freezing temperatures. And your words were, do not put your hope in the leadership in making a difference towards a better future. It's not the few saving the situation, but the many, and the many are missing. Spend your money as if tomorrow matters. Live as if the future is important. So can you explain how your work as a farmer aims to help the environment?
Well, that's going to be a little long answer.
Okay, try to put it into a couple sentences if you can.
Oh, I've got a miserably failed here.
No worries. I'm curious to hear your answer.
Let's just simplify it a lot. If you live in a city, the lifestyle you have is either going to be higher or lower on the carbon footprint. With other words, your AC is down at 68 in the summer, and in the winter you heat your house at, you know, 98, and then you drive a Guzzler, and, you know, you don't think twice to go to the supermarket for, you know, a root beer. So, you know, your whole life is really just using up carbon to get from here to there, and using up carbon. When you burn fossil fuel, you use up carbon.
Right.
So I can then, you know, live in the city and have an electric car and think twice before I go somewhere, combine my trips, buy local because local has a lower carbon footprint. You know, don't turn on my AC in the summer. In the winter, put on my long underwear, etc. So my lifestyle is really just how do I reduce the footprint?
Right.
And then, yes, you can grow a few house plants to improve your indoor air quality. But as a farmer, Rodale talked about it, and also there's Alan Yeoman. He's an Australian fella who wrote Priority One. And it's a book which gives you a really good overview of how the globe works. And in there, he has a whole chapter. And in that chapter, he talks about, you know, when you look at all the stuff which is released, that extra carbon released in the atmosphere, half of it is industries, is living. It's just, you know, how people live and it's industry, etc. And the other half is agriculture or agribusiness. Now, so 25% of that extra carbon is going into, like, nitrogen fertilizer production. So that's a huge part. It goes into chemical production.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 25% is, will be a good example, it will be the Dust Bowl. When you have Earth go away, you have carbon go into the air.
Uh-huh.
You know, for example, we hear about the permafrost thawing up. And there is, I forgot the exact statistics, but there is what more carbon stored in there than it's in the atmosphere right now. Or something tremendous.
Hmm.
So now, Yeoman puts forth, and he's not the only one, that if we farmers, something like, what was it? Oh, let's 6-7% of the global surface is arable land, meaning you can till it.
Yep.
If we would increase the average organic matter content in those, whatever, 7% by 1.6%, we would reverse global warming.
Wow.
So that was a tremendous message for hope.
When did that book come out? That's just such a compelling call to action.
Oh, it's over 20 years ago.
Okay. I'll link
you
it
know,
on my...
You know, like, when did we come up with quantum physics?
Okay, I didn't
take
physics.
How does that affect your daily life?
Okay.
I mean, that would be a whole other discussion, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. But I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you that, you know, if you can contribute to keeping carbon within the ground... Right. And you know, another thing that you talk about all the time is keeping the soil healthy, keeping the earth nutrient rich, then that's doing a big part.
Yeah. But we're not just talking keeping the carbon in the ground. We're talking about increasing the carbon in the ground.
Okay.
The reverse of what has done.
Okay.
And that increasing turns out to be quite a big challenge. But now, see... And that goes back a bit. If I, as a farmer, you know, want to farm organically, and that is more labor intense, and
you do farm organically, we should make it
and
clear.
And we do farm organically.
Yeah, you go through all of the process.
And at the same time, want to reverse global warming, meaning we want to increase organic matter content in our soil. And then we do that in a criteria that we have to come up with cheap food. And this cheap food is sort of a fascinating thing. Is what is the average-wise, the average French person spends 22% of his take-home on food. The average American spends 11%.
Yeah, that is one of the most important statistics. Yeah,
right.
That's
and I have not come to the insight that French people are France is a third-world country. You know, it's Michael Moore had that recent documentary, Where to Invade Next, and they look at the cafeteria on a French public school, and, I mean, it's a whole different emphasis.
Yeah.
You know, but coming back a bit, I think when I grew up, when I was younger, if we spent 20-25% of our income on rent, that was as much as we should. And today, a lot of people spend, 40-50% on their income and rent.
Right.
And that's money they can't spend on sustainable food production.
Yep. So, Heinz, can I ask you, I have about 2 more minutes to ask you questions. And as it relates to adding more carbon into the ground, are the legumes and seeds that you produce and then actually are purchased by Seilu and turned into horse bread, are those part of that effort? And can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, to have a healthy organic farm system, we need diversity.
Right.
You know, when I look out and look at the forest, it's probably easy to see 20, 30, 40 different species. And then if we want to have as organic farm, which is monoculture over and over again, we violate a principle in sustainable farming. So the diversity is important. Different plants use and give different nutrients to the soil. So from that alone, we need a diversity. For interrupting of disease cycles, we need diversity.
Right.
So the diversity is an essential key in sustainable and organic farms. And then the debate about organic versus sustainable, that's a whole different, you know.
Right. That's another show. So But which legumes and seeds do you sell to Selu for the horse bread? Because that's just been so popular, and people would love to know.
Oh, this is, you know, when Jonathan started out, that was a year we did a whole bunch of research in growing southern peas.
Yeah.
And we were not successful enough to continue growing southern peas, but that's the original horse bread. I think now it's more camelina, which is a mustard, which is more, I think he even may have some yellow mustard in there.
Yeah.
And I assume he will switch over to the other beans like kidney beans, et cetera, you know, cannellini beans.
I'll ask him next episode. I'll ask him what he's planning in that vein.
Yeah.
And then
that's going to be a changing process. You know, as I said, there was one year we did a lot of research on southern peas, and we just felt that we're not going to be able to make it.
Well, luckily, you two are in conversation so often that it seems like you're really kind of in it together, planning what you're going to plant, and, you know, he's communicating how he uses it, and it's an evolution, as you say.
It's an evolution, and the evolution should also be among everybody, because it's not going to be us. Was it less than 2% of the U.S. population is farming, and out of that, about 1% is organic. We cannot put all our hopes in that 1% thinking they're going to save the globe.
Right. Right.
It's for the and that goes back what the person at home can do, as you said in the introduction, and that is really evaluating the lifestyle. What is important, and is the future of our children or our own old age important enough that we make decisions today that we have a good tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I noticed when I visited you was that we sat down to lunch with your wife and your daughters and our friend Nani for about an hour and a half. And you have so much to do on your farm, yet you took that time for, you know, deep conversation together and to share the crops that you had grown. So you actually led perfectly to my very last question for you, Heinz, and that is your action item. Remember, I warned you that I would ask you for one thing that, you know, most of our listeners are urban dwellers, and they are the ones that are, you know, maybe trying to make a difference by having an electric car or growing house plants. And you just said it's about, you know, making a difference in how you live. So what do you ask Lunch Agenda listeners to do to try to change the environment or any part of the food system for the better?
I don't think there's going to be a single silver bullet. It's really...
one small thing, even if it's where to find your products.
One small thing is not going to do it anymore. It takes a sort of a radical approach on looking at your AC, looking at your heater, looking at, you know, are you wearing natural clothes? Do you still have a lawn you mow every week? Can that not just be a wildflower meadow so the bee benefits a bit more? And then, you know, where are you shopping? You know, as I said earlier, wherever you spend your money, that's what you are supporting.
Right, right. So vote with your dollars.
Yeah. You shop organic at Walmart, you're still going to say yes to minimum wage.
Right, right.
I mean, I haven't heard that Walmart employees got a huge bonus out of that last tax break.
No, neither have I. Okay, Heinz, I'm going to move on because we have one more guest today. I love learning from you. And if there's one thing I've heard this morning or this afternoon, I should say, it's open your eyes to all of the ways, all of the decisions we make that have an impact on the environment.
I think the biggest part is inform yourself.
Yep, there's the answer.
Really inform yourself of how you are being manipulated. Ask yourself, what are people for, and you know, live accordingly.
Thank you, Heinz. Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much. I'll talk to you soon. So,
Great.
When I asked Heinz over lunch what he thought that our listeners should learn about grain and bread. He went right to flour. You know, we started talking about how something as simple as a bag of flour doesn't get talked about often enough. And it's one of the most ubiquitous ingredients in America. You know, there's this quote from Dan Barber I love. He says, "My aha moment happened one day in the kitchen as I was looking over a bag of all-purpose flour. We use a ton of flour at Blue Hill, but I realized that day I knew nothing about it. I didn't know where it came from or how it was grown. I knew it had no flavor and I knew it was in everything. There I was running a farm-to-table restaurant, but when it came to wheat, I was cooking and baking with what was essentially rotten produce." So now we're going to pivot over. We're going to spend the next few minutes of the show exploring why that might be. And we have a scientist with us who will be able to help. So David, are you on the phone yet? David's joining us from Oakland today.
Yes, I'm on the phone.
Thanks so much for joining, David. So let me introduce you. David Killalay, PhD, is a nutritional biochemist with the Nutrition and Metabolism Center at Children's Hospital, Oakland Research Institute in Oakland, California. David has a particular interest in the nutrient density of whole wheat. And in recent years, he's been researching the proportions of endosperm, germ, and bran in anonymous samples of flour. So he's going to hopefully share with us some of that research. So, David, how did you get into flour research?
My bread and butter of my research, if you'll pardon the pun, is the mineral analysis of a variety of different types of samples, oftentimes biomedical, but a few agricultural groups reached out to us, and one of the questions that they wanted to know was the mineral differences between, like, all-purpose flour and whole grains. And when I ran that on our instruments, it was just shocking. I mean, the data's out there. It's not completely new information, but just to see it in my own hands, that this whole wheat flour was just so rich in magnesium and potassium and selenium and zinc. And these are minerals that we need on a daily basis to be healthy. And so much of the Western diet is low in many of these. So it was exciting to see a major food group that's a big part of our food system and the diet of every typical American could have so much richer nutrient density if more of it was whole grain.
Right. And so let's start with just simply what is in a grain. I'm going to list a couple things that I've learned about how grains become flour, and please chime in with your expertise. So firstly, what's in a kernel of grain? There are three main components. There's the fibrous outer coating, which is the bran. And then there's the germ, which is flavorful and aromatic, and that's the living embryo that eventually develops into the adult plant. And then finally, the bulk of the mass is a pouch of starch called the endosperm. Did I say that correctly, David?
Absolutely. Those are the three major parts, and there's certainly a lot more complexity to it. It's probably easiest to start just thinking about those three components.
Right. And I believe that over the 20th century, you know, selective breeding has led to some grains that, you know, have an endosperm that's, you know, doubled in size from centuries past, right?
It certainly has gotten bigger.
Right.
For sure.
It's kind of like chicken breasts now that are just like so big that the chicken can't even walk.
Yeah, to walk.
And so then, you know, eventually the grain is milled. And both Hines, the farmer that we just spoke with, and Selu have stone mills that mash, you know, the grain components all together. And so that brings forth a flour that's fragrant and it's brownish gold and speckled. And it has the oils that are released from the living germ and bran. But in modern times, those guys are going against the grain, pardon my pun, they're just too many on this topic, because the steel roller mill dominates the industry now. And
right.
For quick background, that the roller mill was invented in Budapest in 1839, and it shears the wheat, the grain kernel apart. And so what the roller mill allows for is the next step, which is sifting. Often sifting the bran and germ out of flour to create white flour. So, David, can you tell us about your recent studies on the flour found on grocery store shelves today and what you or similar studies have learned?
Sure. I mean, as you pointed out, before the Industrial Revolution, stone milling was pretty common. And it was the three parts were ground together. And the germ that you were talking about, while it is the living embryo and it has an incredibly packed full of nutrients, it also has oils, and those oils can oxidize over time and become rancid. So it sort of sets a timer on your flour once you mill it. It has to be used within a certain period of time. So by moving to the roller mill and then sifting out the fractions, and you could remove the germ, then you didn't have the oil. You were, could get rid of the bran, which has sometimes a bitter taste to it to some people, and then basically have mostly endosperm, which is starch. So this created the ability to keep flour on the shelf for a very long time and to ship it across the country, but the downside was we lost out in nutrition. And so now we're sort of back calculating how we can bring whole food, whole wheat grain back into the diets of most people. And so if you look on any typical shelf of the grocery store for flour, it will still be dominated by the white flour, the all-purpose flour. And so that's a really easy one to talk about. It's missing so many of the minerals and the vitamins, also the fiber and other plant compounds that we're just now understanding have really important health values to not only us, but to the bugs that live in our guts. And microbiome is a big topic now, and a happier gut is a happier person. So the whole wheat flours definitely feed those systems.
So
what's
an example of a nutrient or mineral that is not in white flour that's really present in a whole fresh milled flour?
Oh, goodness. There are a long list. One of the most deficient vitamins in the typical American diet is vitamin E. Vitamin E is also known as, it has a couple of different chemical classes, tocopherols and tocotrienols. And these compounds are reduced by about 90% when you go from whole wheat flour to the all-purpose flour, the white flour. And so that's the very, I would say, one of the most deficient vitamins in our typical diet, and yet we're losing about 90% of it.
Wow.
In the milling process. So that's just one example. Many of the B vitamins are missing. Many of the minerals, zinc, magnesium, tend to be depleted by either 2 to 4-fold. Potassium is low. And so there is some interest in adding back, of course, with enriched flour. But it's really key to point out, because a lot of people get confused. They think that it's enriched, okay, so we're putting those nutrients back in. It's only 4 vitamins and 1 mineral that is added back into enriched flour, vitamins B1, 2, and 3, and 9, and then iron. So there's no addition of zinc or potassium or magnesium or vitamin E, which was just probably the most depleted in the milling process, does not get added back. And those are just the traditional vitamins. There are the non-traditional plant compounds that we depend on, fiber. It's not just for keeping the internal trains running in time. It's really important for feeding the gut bacteria. We know it helps reduce cholesterol levels, and it improves insulin regulation, so it's important for weight control and for insulin signaling. And flavonoids, these are like the compounds that you might find in green tea or red wine. Wheat has plenty of them, and they're also really important for stimulating metabolism and also used by gut bacteria and have a lot of pro-health benefits.
It's amazing, the world of nutrition in a tiny grain that is smaller than my pinky.
And this is what's amazing to me. I often call the wheat kernel as a superfood, and the nutritionists bustle at that because that's more of a marketing term than actual science. But there's this feeling that a superfood is some special berry growing on the banks of the Amazon that you have to be wealthy to afford a lot of it on your yogurt in the morning. But the reality is we have access to a superfood all the time through whole wheat flour.
I love that. I love that. That makes a lot of sense. So I want to quickly talk about what else is done to flour and then ultimately bread and the health side effects there. So can you tell us about bleaching, to the extent that that is applied to any bag of white flour or any bag of flour in the grocery store today?
Sure. That's, one of the leading issues there is the perception that the typical American has. It's not probably limited to America, but there's the that flour should be white and pristine and clean, I think, is another sort of strange relationship topic that we have with our food now. We want our food to be clean. And so this desire, this market is pushed that way, so whiter flour tends to sell well. The unfortunate side of it is that color is generated by really useful and nutritional biocompounds. There are carotenoids, so these are, as you might guess, with the root word shared with carrot, these are colored, longer lipid-like vitamins that often are in the vitamin A family, or they have similar sort of relationships. Lutein is one of the common ones. It's in wheat, and that gives a sort of a nice yellow-golden color to it. And then also those polyphenolic or flavonoid compounds, like I mentioned earlier, that are in green tea and soy and red wine, those have color as well. So when you bleach flour, you're actually destroying those compounds. You are chemically changing them so that they're not useful to the body in the same way anymore.
And what other chemicals are allowed to be added in the U.S. today? I've read lists like chlorine, chlorine dioxide, benzoyl peroxide. What are in our flour right now?
Well, there's also brominated compounds as well. There are conditioners. So there's a long list, and I'm reluctant to try to go down the list because it's not my expertise.
Sure.
But they're definitely, the market has moved to putting stabilizers and bleaches and other types of compounds in. But there has been some market recognition, consumer recognition of that has changed the market. And I've noticed more and more wheat from major companies are saying that they're not treated or that they've been not bleached. And so that's a good trend, and I hope we keep moving in that direction.
Right, because have you heard theories that it may be the bleach and the other chemicals that flour is being treated with that people are reacting to when they decide to eliminate bread from their diet, as opposed to, thinking that it might be gluten that's upsetting them, but it might actually be these chemical agents?
I've heard, as you can imagine, all sorts of theories about all sorts of components, and it's not to say that there's not a role for particularly some of the conditioners, like the brominated conditioners. There are studies that show that these compounds, particularly when tested in isolation in animal models, have negative consequences.
Right.
There's also, of course, the pesticides concern.
Absolutely.
Those are absolutely real concerns. Whether or not they are a major contributor to what people feel like happens to them when they eat wheat and identify it as a problem with wheat, that's, I think, it's really hard to determine what the relative proportional risk is. And it probably differs from person to person as well.
And I understand you're trying to do more of this research, and so that will require more funding. But, you'd like to delve deeper into this nutrition side of flour, right?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly, we know a lot about the vitamins and minerals, the classic vitamins and minerals, but these additional bioactive components of the short and long chain fibers, the flavonoids, the lignans is a really important topic now. These are all just the wheat kernel is just absolutely full. It's a pharmacopoeia of fantastic compounds that work either directly in us or they are used by the bugs in the bacteria in our gut to make them happy and sort of stimulate the right conditions for the right bugs to be there and the less healthy bugs to be pushed out. So funding is not easy to get in general for scientific research, and nutrition seems to be one, and surprisingly, is the fact that it affects everybody seems to be on the more difficult side. It's a little bit easier to get funding for cancer or Alzheimer's right now than it is to get funding for nutrition. But I would certainly argue that good nutrition is what sets you up for a healthier long-term life anyway. So it's
sounds logical to me.
Difficult.
And so, David, I have one moment to ask you the last question, which is your agenda item. What's the action that you want our listeners to take?
Well, it's probably pretty obvious that would push for eating more whole grains. The grain component of the American diet is particularly high. You're looking at some people 50% of their diet. Wheat is a vast majority of those grains are wheat. Obviously, some cultures favor rice or corn more, but wheat is still pretty ubiquitous, particularly in the U.S. And you're supposed to get 6 servings, and the government is really pushing to the idea that at least make 3 of your servings whole. Make half your grains whole is sort of the motto they use. And I would push for even more than that. The benefits of whole grains are incredible. The epidemiology that we have that shows a reduced risk of diabetes, cardiovascular disease markers go down, cholesterol goes down, it's easier for weight maintenance, inflammation in the gut tends to go down. Now, there is certainly a concern about wheat right now for a lot of people who are worried about digestibility and the changes that you were just talking about earlier in the marketplace that has happened. But for those who can eat wheat and tolerate it, it is really the best, easiest way to incorporate superfoods back into your diet.
Great, great. And David, I know that you contribute research to Community Grains out in Oakland, so I'm going to invite the listeners to follow your research at their Instagram account, Community Grains. I'll also have David's research site linked at kikosfoodnews.com, as well as links to Heinz's Farm Next Step Produce. So David, thank you so much. And I'll be sharing pictures from today's interview on my Instagram, KikoBuff. If you share this podcast and want to tell all your friends to go out and eat more grain and feel really validated about the nutrition that they'll be getting, you can tag Lunch Agenda when you share it. Next Monday, when Lunch Agenda's Breadjucation series continues, I'll talk with the bakers and owners of Salu to learn what it takes to turn whole grains into tasty, chewy loaves of bread and airy, flaky croissants, which many have found near to impossible to do. So tune in next week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today.